Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Welcome to a very special bonus episode of One Heat Minute Productions. I am Katie Walsh. I am here talking to my good friend and co-host of Miami Nice, Blake Howard, and we are talking today about physical media, which is something we love. We celebrate here at One Heat Minute Productions.
I just added a new shelf in my office, Katie, like yesterday. I'm running out of space because physical media is so important to me. And with films and box sets like we're going to talk about today, you need them to take up. You need the space so you can have these things occupy the space. Special, special things like what we're talking about today.
Yeah, we are talking about one of the best physical media releases of the past year. I know when it was announced, everybody's jaws were on the floor. It sold out like instantly. But it is for the 1993 Super Mario Brothers. It is the Trust the Fungus edition. Is that? Yes.
Yeah.
It is the 30th anniversary of the movie Trust the Fungus edition. It is a huge, amazing box set filled with so many, like, you are not getting more extras. Like, the movie is like the smallest thing in this thing. You're getting scripts, interviews, a movie magazine, behind the scenes stuff. It's incredible. But I don't want to go too deep into the weeds because we have to introduce our guest. But I want to give a little preamble about how I found myself in the world of Super Mario Brothers and how I came to get to know our guest, who is Ryan Haas of the Super Mario Brothers Archive. And he is one of the driving forces behind this incredible box set. Welcome, Ryan. And then I will tell how we got to know each other.
Welcome, Ryan. Thank Hello. You so much for doing this.
Hello. Yeah, I'm glad to be here on with the story, because I feel like once you jump into the dimensional wormhole here, it's hard to get out.
It is such a hard wormhole to get out. But yeah, I mean, last year I hosted a screening of Super Mario Brothers at Whammy Analog Media here in LA with my friend Jamie Patterson, who's an incredible VHS collector and enthusiast. And it came about because I simply tweeted that I really wanted someone to do a screening of Super Mario Brothers because it was the 30th anniversary and I have a very palpable, visceral memory of seeing this movie in the theaters when I was 10 years old. And I was talking so much that my friend Clara got up and moved away from me.
During the movie?
During the movie, she was just like
trying to figure it out, or
no, like... she was like, "You're annoying," because I used to just talk in movies like constantly. I've taught myself how not to do that anymore. But she just got up and moved. She was so annoyed with me, but I also like just have a very distinct memory of seeing this, and we were alone. Which, like, my parents were very overprotective about the movies that I saw, but I think they were like, "Oh, it's a video game movie. It's fine." And then you're like, no, this is like a sexy, cyberpunk, weird, scary, futuristic movie. And I think it definitely rewired my brain, especially in a very Bob Hoskins-oriented way.
We'll get to that.
Which we will get to. But anyway, I tweeted that I wanted to do this. My friend Jamie was like, oh, we should do this at Whammy. And then she suggested we screen this very special cut of the movie, which was available on the Internet Archive, which has been known as the Morton Jenkel cut, but we are no longer calling it that. But it was basically a director's cut of the film. So then we were just like promoting it. I get a DM from SMB Archive, which is Ryan. And I can't remember exactly what you said. You were like, hey, I think this is our
cut. I'm sure it was Steven. It's like me. Oh. Yeah. Me and Steven.
Okay.
Yeah. Like it's, I started the website in 2007 and then Steven Applebaum came on board shortly after when we started to really kind of become an archive. It went from like, hey, I want to make a fan site. And then it slowly crept into like, we can be more than that. And Steven was really instrumental in that. So it's okay. Both of us that are kind of the Mario and Luigi, as it were.
Of course.
We kind of have morphed into that. So yeah, Steven is the one that is usually on the social media and is always hunting for who's talking about the movie. How can we, you know, politely like advocate for the film and see who's talking about it and what's the conversation. And yeah, I'm sure he was probably the one that was like, hey, we're the reason that cut exists or is out there, and like, how can we like help?
Yes. Yeah. And then
both of us were talking with you throughout that whole process.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that I loved how sort of like warm and welcoming you were, and how sort of positive the Twitter presence of SMB Archive is. I mean, you guys are really just like cheerleaders and fans of the movie and are supportive of everyone who wants to do anything with the movie. So even with you guys saying, oh, hey, I think this is our cut, can you not call it the Morton Jenkel cut, which is how it's, you know, on Internet Archive. You know, I started to hear more about like your journey to like finding this work print, which was like maybe on a VHS tape. I don't know. We'll hear the story, but it is now available finally on the release. And the work print, the director's cut, I guess you're, what is the cut we're calling it now? The Trust Fungus cut. It's such a better movie.
Restored extended work print is like the technical term for it. Like the cut that's actually on the disc, we have called it I think it's called the lasagna work print, actually. And there's a really fantastic YouTube documentary that was made by our restorationist J.S. Wingfield of the Bigger Pictures. And he goes into why he called it that. And he calls it that because of how he restored it. Basically, there's like five different passes that he made of this VHS tape to extract different information. I'll get the tech specs wrong, but like the color detail from this and the grain from that and the chroma from this and that. And there are five passes, five layers that all combine to create like the best possible quality you could possibly get out of this like secondhand, not meant for public consumption VHS of a tele, you know, whatever, like screen that a producer would use to just review the state of the film, which was around December of 1992, you know, half a year before the movie came out. So we were able to kind of take that and get into the right hands people and eventually have it make its way onto a real physical media for, you know, not just rest, you know, not just for our own, you know, enjoyment, but selfishly, but to get it out there and present it in the best possible quality that you could get. You know, it's kind of it's one of those things where we try to take our position as stewards of the movie and the positivity around it. We don't take that lightly. And we see so many there are fans of things, but there are fans of niches of things, and work prints and work print collectors is kind of its own weird niche. And it's really easy to get a hold of work prints, but they're just horrible quality. And they're not, because like I said, they're not meant for like real, collectors just like them. You know, it's not like it takes a lot to go from a niche thing that people just a niche curiosity to something that's like fit for public consumption, even in an archival capacity. So we really tried to pull out all the stops and spare no expense, as it were, to like get that VHS restored the best possible way we could to be included on that disc.
You guys remind me of, there's a brilliant guy who works with Sam Peckinpah's archive named Mike Siegel, who some of his recent releases that have been coming out on physical media, they've been able to find Peckinpah's work prints or Peckinpah's private prints and have the restoration process undergo so that you see a version of the film, like a theatrical version, which has a, you know, a pristine work print that, a pristine theatrical print that's, you know, been in an archive somewhere. They clean it up. They do what we see a lot. There's, you know, you guys on that and him on the work of Sam Peckinpah is just like, he's been curating every potential print, even like traveling over to Germany at one point, because there was someone in an archive in Germany or was like in Eastern Europe that had like a print of the movie that had never been seen in the United States. And so then they cleaned that up and brought it back and completely gave new life to it. So yeah, it's an insane thing. It's so cool to hear that, especially you guys kind of being LA based, that it's, you can get your hands on these things, because usually it's just in the realm of internet rumor that these things exist. And us as Michael Mann fans, Katie and I, we always hear about, there was a print that goes to, you know, FX of a version of a movie, and then that's never seen again. And you need people like saving it, ripping it, trying to uplift it on, and giving a version that only exists on the internet. And you're like, if only someone could put all the three or four prints that exist of this thing onto a disc so I could consume them with the right special features, I would buy it in an instant. And I think that's the Trust the Fungus is like. Honestly, Katie was, I don't think you were being hyperbolic, Katie. I think this is maybe like the best release I've seen in the last maybe 10 years. This is the Trust the Fungus collection is an unbelievable release. It's like peerless, with the amount of dedication to just one film that has gone into a set. And so, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. So you guys meet, you start having a conversation. What happens between you guys having a conversation between then and actually you meeting and doing this event?
Yeah. Well, we just were in touch about this screening, and we were making little, Jamie was making trading cards, and we had someone fly in from like North Carolina or something. And
he's the Luigi's Mansion 2 guy.
He's the sweetest guy, and he's really dedicated to a sequel that is dedicated to Luigi's Mansion and starring John Leguizamo. And he showed up, he like was handing out stickers and patches, and like I just found myself tumbling into this world, like, oh my god, I didn't know this even existed. I mean, JM is still sending me stickers. I have to be better about putting them up around town, because he's just doing it because he is so passionate about this cause, which is the sequel. But yeah, and we ended up getting in touch with Parker Bennett, who's one of the writers of the film, and he came and did a Q&A, and we, you know, sort of sent you guys like some of our materials because you're the archivists. So we've just been in touch since then, which has been really nice, and I obviously have been so thrilled to see this Umbrella release, because it really feels like such a culmination of like everything you guys have done for so long. But I am curious, like in 2007, when you're like, we have to start an archive for Super Mario Brothers, like what had you been obsessed with the movie since 1993? Like, what's the origin story of you becoming the steward of this movie?
So 2007, I'm in college, getting my digital media degree, and that's around the era, like internet wise where there are a lot of fan sites at the time. I'm also a big fan of like Batman and like and DC Comics, and my kind of big other than like Mario and video games, I've always been into comics and Batman. And so I always kind of look to Bill Raimi's like Batman on Film as kind of like, oh, that's a fan site done right. And when I was in, and I had been writing for, and I still am part of that website. And I've been part of that ever since I was a senior in high school, writing comic book reviews and things like that. So so I'm like, okay, Batman's taken care of. That fandom's fine, you know?
You're like, he's in good hands.
Yeah, like Batman's fine. Batman's been around for 85 years or whatever. Mario is fine. But like video games are a much newer art form. And then of course Super Mario Brothers is the first live action movie based on a video game. I didn't see it in the theater when it first came out. I saw it. Well, I remember when it came out on VHS, and I remember my parents not letting me actually see it. I remember going into our local video store. It was called Popcorn Video because you got free popcorn with every VHS. And it just closed within the last 3-4 years, actually, sadly.
Oh, Popcorn Video.
RIP Popcorn Video.
It stuck around as much as humanly possible. But I remember going in there and seeing the big advertisements, the big M, cardboard standee.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't even really a gamer at the time. You know, I was just a kid. I was like second grade, something like that. And I was like, what is that? That looks cool. That looks awesome. And then we rented the movie, and they were like, mom and dad were like, well, we should watch it first and see if it's something you can watch. And then they watched it and they were like, no, that's too heavy for you or whatever. And then, so I kind of forgot about it until a few years later, where it was just kind of randomly on TV one day. And it wasn't even in the crazy Dino Hatton part. It was just in Brooklyn early. And for whatever reason, I was like glued to the screen, and I was like, this is interesting. And I was just about to go to a friend's house for the night, and I was like, what is this, dad? He's like, oh, that's the Mario movie. And I was like, you mean that's the movie you didn't let me see a couple years ago? And he just was like, oh, we didn't let you see that? Like, he was just like, he didn't even remember how like formative that was. So went to the friend's house, we rented it that night, and I was like so enamored with it. And I think I annoyed my friend to the point where I was like, we watched it, and then we like watched it again. And then I was like, because by that time I had played some of the games, and I was like, how did this happen? What are the correlations between the game and the movie? And so like, I was like, I started the movie for the third time, and I started taking notes of like, okay.
Oh my God.
Parallel dimension. Mario is this, there's a roto disc. There's Wiggler on a cab. Like what are the connections? So I was already starting to kind of form this idea there of like, and I can imagine must be how some kids felt. Some kids loved it. Some kids hated it. We have been told so many times from people of like, oh, I saw it as a kid and I got it immediately. The answers are all over the place. Or it's like, I hated it, I loved it, I was confused, but intrigued. And so like, I kind of like, it felt like this weird, like, moment where like all that was kind of flooding at me, and I get that from other movies of the time, like the Back to the Future movies or Batman movies, and this was one of them for sure. Mm-hmm. And so that dovetails into like 1999 when we got our first eBay account, and I was like in fifth grade, and the very first, you know, it's our family eBay account, and the very first thing I got purchased on eBay was the soundtrack CD for Super Mario Brothers.
Nice.
And it went from that to me just trying to kind of build a collection of what I missed out on, because I love the movie. I just wanted to find out more about it. So I got that. I got the action figures. I got there's a making of book that was actually targeted for kids that you could get like at a kid's book fair called Microchips to Movie Stars. I actually have the Japanese version of that here.
Oh my God.
It's just the cover. I've been doing scans, and the archiving never stops.
Yeah.
literally. And then that led into me getting winning a archive of pre-production material from Profiles in History, that from David L. Snyder, who was the production designer of Super Mario Brothers. And it was like $400. It was like so much money back in the day. But like, well, yeah. But as far as like film screen use stuff from a film, like today, that's like, whoa, you got a deal.
Yeah.
So I, especially now that it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's like we have made the movie so like excessively popular and weird that like we can't even afford to like buy props to get back to the archive because it's so popular now. It's kind of its own bad like thing. But this archive had some scripts, might have had a script, it had photography, it had storyboards, it had like a really cool like before and after print of the Ideal Cement Factory in Wilmington where they filmed most of the movie, of like Koopa Square before, like it's like a dead derelict cement factory, and then after, so you could like see like all the work that they did to turn it into stuff. And so I got that, and then a few years later I'm in college and I'm like, I have all this stuff. See, it needs to be seen. It needs to be appreciated somehow. I had that part of it. And then the other part was like the internet and internet fandoms kind of forming. And there were Mario websites, but either they didn't mention the movie, or if they did mention the movie, there was like a page and it was like, hey, there was a movie in 1993. It was kind of weird, wasn't it? And then that's kind of the extent. And then the movie would be on things like the IMDb had like the bottom 100 and Mario was on there. And like the pervasive narrative about the film was like, it's so bad, it's good. Or it was the worst movie ever made because it was such a failure and all this. And for me, I'm like, I don't think there's more to it than that. It's just misunderstood. And there's more to dissect there than like this throwaway thing. And don't you see how important it is? It's the first video game movie. That's the live action video game movie. So all those pieces kind of combined, plus like me being inspired by websites like Batman on Film, to where I was like, okay, I can do this. I think nobody but me is going to do this or cares. Like, I don't know if anybody else cares, but I'm going to do this. And so I made this website, and I've got a little notebook over there. Like in college, like I just started like sketching out, like, this is what the website should look like. These are all the sections I need. I need to cover like pre-production and production and post-production and like articles, and like here's all the stuff I have. And so like I just started building the website and learning HTML so I could like do this thing. And so really I just put it all out there and cataloged all the stuff I had, and then made a forum so we could just have like a place for the fandom to emerge and for people to start talking. And it kind of just grew from there. And then people that worked on the film kind of started finding the page. The first interview we had was Mark McCoy, who worked on the special effects crew. He was a engineer. He's part of the commentary crew on one of the tracks on the Umbrella release. And he did like an interview with us on the forums. And he was like, oh yeah, and this is how we made the fungus. And oh, I've got pictures and stuff from the movie, and do you want them? I'm like, yeah. Like, so he like scanned them, and we got all this new stuff that we had never seen before. And that's kind of started to click with me of like, oh my God, we can do interviews with people and we can talk to people and we can get more stuff, and it can just snowball. And right after that is when Steven Applebaum kind of recruited himself to be part of the cause, and I took care of the website stuff, and he took care of the community outreach kind of portion of it, which is so funny because really you'd think if you meet both of us, you would think those roles really should be flipped the way we work. But it just has worked out that way because we're both like very methodical, and we both like kind of contribute in unique ways to our ultimate goal here. He somehow was able to get in touch with Mojo Nixon and convinced him, who played Toad in the film, and convinced him to do a interview with us. And this was back in like, you know, 2008, 2009, something like that. When we did those interviews, like Zoom wasn't prevalent. Recording podcasts were still like in their infancy. So like it's one of those things, like I didn't realize how pioneering in a way it was at the time. Cause I like, how do I do this? And I wanted to make it easy for these people to come to talk to us. I didn't want to be like, oh, we'll send you a microphone and get on the computer and do X, Y, and Z. I'm like, we have to, if we get in touch with these people, we're going to conform to their schedule, their time zone. You know, we had Brian Jennings. He was in like Africa and stuff. We're like, we're going to do whatever we have to do to like get the info from these people. So like Steven was scheduling these things, not knowing if I was available. But it didn't matter. And I was like, we have to do it. So we were like super into like getting that done. And I downloaded like phone call recording software onto my iPhone. So like when you would call somebody, it would have this pre-recorded like message where it was like, you're about to be recorded. Is that okay? And then the first thing I have like for Mojo Nixon, he's like, hey, there's this thing on the phone. It asked me to do this. That was pretty stupid. You know, that's fine. You can post this and I don't give a shit. And like, he was like, really, he was exactly who you would expect. It kind of kicked off that whole era of the website where we interviewed as many people as possible. And we have all these audio recordings, but they're not like super good quality. So we went and meticulously to transcribe them and posted them on the site and made them like archival quality as far as we could make them. And it just snowballed from there. You know, our influence and notoriety, as it were, grew to the point of like, you know, we interview one person, they know two people or three people, or oh, there's this other person and they don't normally give interviews, but like they know you're legit because there's the site and you've talked to these 10 people and stuff like that. So
welcome to the story of one hate minute, my friend. That's exactly,
I know I'm saying, it sounds, I'm seeing some similarities.
Yeah, it sounds very familiar. It's like you get grandfathered in. Like once you start talking, you're like, someone is genuinely passionate about this thing. It's not a gotcha interview. It's not just looking for the next clickbait headline that's going to say, oh, this happened or this was this. It's like, no, I'm genuinely interested. I really want to know just absolutely everything because we're trying to reverse engineer it in our heads. And I think, you know, you made a great comparison before, Ryan, of like, what's fascinating about this is like, and you can see it in the materials you guys have brought together. It's going, and I can understand it from your Batman lens. It's like, okay, when someone adapts Batman, what are the trace elements of like the best Batman stories that they've just tried to cherry pick and somehow
translate from one medium to another
and blur into this thing? And did any of it hold together across the medium? Right. So I can see exactly what you're saying there, but it's like, I also remember crappy phone recording technology that would interface with Skype and things like that before Zoom just like did everything effortlessly. Like, you know, I don't even know. I've got all these old recordings from the first podcast I recorded and they're on Zoom recordings and weird formats and stuff like that. I don't even know if I've still got the apps, but all the recordings exist. So yeah.
But I think it's also interesting that between you guys is like, if you build it, they will come. Yes. Where you just started the thing because you love the thing.
Yeah.
And you're not waiting to start for once you have an interview with Mojo Nixon or the editor of Heat or whatever. Like you're just doing it because you have to do it.
Yeah. Right.
And there is a sense of personal satisfaction that you're getting out of like talking to your friends about Heat or creating an archive of all the stuff that you have from this very underloved movie that everyone said was a piece of shit. And it's not. But yeah, it's just very like you do it and then you attract like attracts like. So I love that kind of just like making a place for it and seeing what happens and just following the journey as it goes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
I mean, and it's one of those things where we are continually rewarded for continuing that like mission. You know, and that's the kind of thing. It's like, well, how passionate are you? It's like, is there ever a point where like you like don't like this movie anymore? And it's like, no. We love it. Like it just doesn't stop. It's like a lot of it's kind of weird. It's like we've seen so many and our opinions on it have evolved surely over the years, but the internet has shown us like the good, the light and dark side of fandom.
Totally.
And we are and we know what we don't want to be. And
the darkness doesn't last. The darkness is like,
see, and Star Wars is the easiest thing to point at. And I just, you know, we look at like Star Wars fandom and it's just like, man, look at how much content you guys have. You know what we have? One movie. That's all we're ever going to have.
Yeah.
You have so much to like appreciate, you know? And So like
Star Wars, this is a Blake Howard message, not Ryan, not approved by Katie, not approved by Ryan.
Retweets are not endorsements.
Star Wars is a garbage fandom, and I love Star Wars. It's the worst fandom that exists. And one other fandom that I love to pieces is the Lord of the Rings fandom, because they remind me of the Super Mario. Like they have, they basically ignore the Hobbit movies. All they think of is those three movies, and the memes and the love and the silliness and the just enduring awesomeness is just like, that's the way you fan. If you want to model a fan, it's like, and so the same with you guys. It's like, the Super Mario thing, it's like, yeah, for the longest time, you know, until very recently, I can see in the background on Katie's bookshelf is like Heat 2. It's like, all we had was Heat. All I had is this one movie that I love more than any other thing. That's all I have. I don't care. Like, you know, imagine a universe where you've got all these different films and all these different sequels. Yeah. It's like, no, it's just, you got this one thing. But yeah, so there's my other thing to say. Star Wars is a garbage fandom. That's Blake. right. I love your love for it. Like, I think, and that's also, it's infectious, right? It is. Well, to keep digging, and exactly, I think that's what Super Mario Brothers scratched for me last night. And because I'm like literally holding, you've got this. There's a couple of amazing pieces that I'm literally holding in my hand. There's, I imagine, like your archive is this sort of a collection of behind the scenes experiences and art. And I had it open while I was watching last night, and I was like flicking through the production.
Oh, that's a cool way to do it. I haven't done that.
I was doing it because I really loved all of the tactile dinosaur heads and stuff, and watching all of the, just the beautiful expressive stuff that all the animatronics were doing. And I was like, oh, they're fascinating. And I'm flicking through, and I did the thing that you talked about, which is I was looking at the original concept art, and I was like, wait, how does Bowser, like, how did the idea of Bowser and Koopa and these things sort of emerge? How did they get Toad, how did they translate from like pre-production art into this
pixel, I'm like
wow, like this really changed. And then you start digging into the interviews. And so I then wasn't second screening. I was second reading. I was looking at this book, and I'm watching the movie again, and I'm going, God, it's amazing. Like, I think that distance between, you know, what they were originally thinking to what was on the screen becomes this other area of fascination as well.
Yeah. And it's such a testament to like we have the hindsight of the 30 years. Yes. Of the film and the video game series existing, and you think about we're trying to piece the puzzle together, but that's what they were doing too, and they made the movie.
Yes
And it's crazy with hindsight to go back now that we have this 4K. What's so great about it is because now we've got the extra details, so we can pause things, we can look at things. They were so committed to the, in so many departments, despite all of the issues and the production, whatever, they still came out with, it's the money and the effort still on the screen. And that does not translate to like many of the films of today. Cause you can just digitally just be like, no, yes. But like, we catch things every day. And like in our Discord, people be like, oh, hey, did you see like on this frame, there's this thing? Or like, oh my God, I've never seen that before. Like,
oh my gosh.
And the most random love examples Discord. Is like in there's so many versions of the script, but for us, that's great just because that's different, like peeks into the dimensional nature of the film. And there's more like story points you can extrapolate from it. There were, I don't know if it was a mention in one of the scripts or concept art, this is Steven's like realm, he would know exactly which page in which draft it was on, but like there's this idea of like, you know, the fungus is not just a person, or before the fungus was even thought of as being like the de-evolved king, it was like it's the fungus is this oppressive force, or it's, you know, it's the end of days, and kind of it's like a Watchmen inspired thing where there's like, oh, we're gonna have there's somebody in the script, it's like there's somebody walking around with like, the fungus is judgment and we're all gonna die or whatever. And then like there's this screenshot like that we found that's in the movie that you can see in the 4K. If you pause it and you zoom in, somebody's carrying the sign that says the fungus is judgment and blah 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 blah. And Like, they went to that effort to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that it's like there and he's carrying it around in a sea full of people that you only a split second and that you only notice if you have a 4K version of the film 30 years later. Like, it really shows like how, I mean, that example kind of goes to the whole like reason we made the website what it is because we like, you don't have to understand or love it or hate it or whatever, but we need you to appreciate the work that they put into like trying to translate these ideas into some sort of tangible form, even if it doesn't all work or whatever. Nothing's perfect, but they try. And the fact that, and at the end of the day, the fact that it's like based off of an iconic basic Nintendo video game, just like the crazy icing on the cake.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a father of two children who have relentlessly watched the recent Super Mario Brothers movie, when I was watching last night, because I've had to have that on in my house or in my car on an iPad driving long distances or whatever, I'm like, Super Mario Brothers animation is essentially structurally the same movie. It's the same.
It's scary like, how it's, close it's, it is.
It's like they just went, we like that it starts in Brooklyn. We like a portal to an alternate dimension. We like that a child went back and forth through the different worlds. We like that it sort of half ends in Brooklyn and then goes back to
the
other world. And all that other stuff. I'm like, except we just are not going to go horny leather daddy weird. We're just going to make it for children. And in some respects, some would say that's a good idea, but on this podcast, I'm unequivocally going to say it is not a good idea.
Oh my God. Ryan, when did you guys start to sort of like see the winds shift on this movie, like temperature wise, in terms of people coming around to it? Because like, I feel like Blake and I have kind of
we've watched it happen with our projects, and we are it's so fascinating to hear with you. Like, when did you hear? Because we ask lots of people who are actually part of the thing. You know, you're a producer. Yeah. It's like, did you ever feel it? Because we can't track it anymore. You know, I think Katie sometimes goes, I don't remember talking as much about heat until I met you, and I'm like, I don't remember when I went from I felt like I was alone to I felt like I was part of a huge phalanx, an incredible international community of people that were like, this is it.
Right. It is kind of a crazy journey. And, you know, my day job is I mean, I'm also a video game developer. So I work on games all day and I work on this project in my limited free time. So I'm always so close to projects and it's always so hard to see the forest for the trees in terms of like, is this good? Do people care? Like all this kind of stuff. So we do rely on this external feedback and it has been this gradual thing where, you know, we did all our stuff. Our first, a huge like community milestone, I would say, was for us was in 2012. We did a 19th anniversary screening at the New Art in LA. Yeah. And I took Stevens in California. I'm in North Carolina, you know, just an hour and change away from where they filmed the movie. And I took like a red eye, crazy, like 24-hour trip to the New Art. It was a midnight screening of the film, but it was like the first time me and Steven met each other in person. It was a film print, the first time we had seen it in the theater on film. We had Parker Bennett, you know, one of the writers we mentioned earlier. We had David Snyder, production designer. We had Dana Kaminsky, who played Daniela, was there. So many people, like Deborah Atwinese, who produced the EPK content, went there. And also that was around the time where, like, me and Steven acquired the rights to that from her so we could use it in stuff, you know.
So
all these crazy things happened. Steven hopped in a because he lives quite a he's in California, but he's in Modesto, so like that's kind of a trek to LA. We had props and costumes and things. He drove to like Dave Berman's workshop to actually get the screen used Koopa heads, like two or three of them. So he's got like all these Koopa heads in the back of the car, and like they had to drive them all down to the new art. So we had this crazy screening, midnight screening, where we had props and all these like people that were involved in the film that we had done interviews with getting to meet us too. But we had no idea who's going to show up for this thing. And there was a line around the block, and it was like, wow. So, and we were just as shocked as everybody else was. And we were doing interviews. Oh, and Brian Jennings, who worked on some of the effects, I got to meet him in person too. Like, I'm sure I'm forgetting some people. Rocky and Annabelle's kids showed up.
Oh, the next
year,
sweet.
I believe. Because like Steven did another one like the next year. So we started just to do interviews with people like in line, like, you know, they didn't know who we were or whatever, but we're just asking them like, why did you show up and what's cool? And so we started to get an idea of like, okay, it's not just us. And like, we introduced the screening, and then we got David L. Snyder to introduce the screening. And I think that screening showed us, and the people that worked on it had told us later on that they were like, oh, we thought this was just kind of a, like David L. Snyder was like, I just thought it was kind of a goof, kind of like a mistake, kind of a failure. Like, it is what it is or whatever. But I think it turned a lot of them around too, in terms of like, even we didn't know kind of what we were making at the time, but we see how appreciated it is now. So that was a big turning point for us. And then crazier things keep happening, like finding the, you know, the work print and doing the multiple Blu-ray releases and things like that. And other like tangible things, like seeing it, it used to be on the IMDb like bottom 100, and now it's like nowhere near that. And then I think it's nowhere near that at all. Worse movies.
It's
come
not
out,
the worst. But it's like, nowhere. You haven't watched enough movies. If you watched this movie and thought that it was the worst, it's like, come on.
Yeah, and then like things like, I think random things happen where it's like it's on a Best Buy circular that's on sale, or it's on like when the Super Mario Brothers movie came out, the Illumination movie came out, like it made the sales of this one like skyrocket. And when the movie hit its 30th anniversary, or 20, maybe 25th anniversary, there was just a lot of like articles out there kind of actually reexamining it in a, in a more like holistic manner. And many of those things would cite the website as like, well, we got the information from them, or like, this is, it's a cult following and look at them and stuff like that. So it's,
they're like, it's look kind at this of, cult.
It's, yeah, I know. Right. But it's kind of, it's definitely
Listen,
helped.
If
like,
you've got Fiona Shaw looking as hot as she is, I want to join the cult. I'm in, Ryan. I'm right there with you.
So when, what year, when did you, I know this is described in one of the pieces that you wrote in the materials, but I do want to hear more about like you guys finding the work print, and then ultimately, I mean, we'll get to this, but you know, I'm curious like how you came to work with Umbrella and actually to release the work print.
Yeah. So
I know that's a big two-part question.
It's a big two-part question.
So,
and
yeah,
I always have to think of like which pieces fit where.
Yeah.
So in part of our like exploration and interviewing as many people as possible in the movie, of course, one of the big things was not just actors and people that worked in the movie, but we wanted to talk to people like you know, producers like Roland Joffe and Jake Eberts, and who were part of, you know, Leitmotiv and Allied Filmmakers, because it all started with them. Like, they were the ones that, you know, Roland Joffe was the one that got on the plane to like get the rights to Nintendo, and like, it all starts with them. Roland was gracious enough to do a sit down filmed interview with us before we even knew what we were going to do with it. You know, so we have this footage. We just do this kind of stuff. We're like Prince. We just make stuff, and then we use it in things, you know, 20 years later. It's weird, but it's what it feels like. We have the SMB movie archive vault here.
Yeah.
The production company, like Steven was trying to get in touch with Leitmotiv and Allied Filmmakers, and do you have any production stuff that we can like look at or like use, or like, do y'all
can
care
we have
anymore?
It
and,
please
and by that can we have it yeah. We want to archive it, but yeah. Like, but you know, and we're always just like, somebody's gonna find out and they're gonna want to shut us down or cease and desist, but it's has yet to happen, which is great. And so like Steven was trying his best to like get in touch with them, and when he finally got a response, it ended up being right after they just completely shuttered and everything like was gone. And it seemed to be like, oh, there was some, I guess everything just defaulted or went into some like storage locker sale, and the stuff's like gone or whatever. And it's like, it wasn't saved at all. Like, luckily David L. Snyder, he worked on Blade Runner. He's a big archivist person. He's donated things to like the Academy and things. And so he's been such a great person, working with us as much as possible to like archive this stuff and get it out there. So we thought like, well, like whatever that the production company had is like just like gone. And then years later, you know, I'm sure it's on our YouTube channel, but like, or I think it was 2019 or something like that. There's this VHS tape that just shows up. It's on eBay of all places. It just shows up on eBay. It's a VHS tape. And the only thing on the VHS tape is like this little strip. Yeah, there's a whole article about it in the extra materials there, but it's on the VHS tape, it just says Super Mario Brothers cut footage 12/1/92. And it's like, and it had like a couple of grainy screenshots of what's on the tape. And the screenshots are from deleted scenes from the movie. Like, we know that's not part of the movie, but so we're like, what the hell is this tape? Is it a VHS of cut footage? Is it all the deleted scenes on a VHS tape? That's weird. Why would it be that? What is this? We have to get it. Luckily,
your eBay game must be great.
Oh, but it's not me. Like, I have, and that's why I was mentioning it's the problem. Like, I have my own eBay notifications, but so does everybody else that's like in the
community. Oh, so they're like, community. Guys, have you seen? Oh, that's the best thing about your community is that that's so cool.
So thank God for this. Is like one of our community members bought it, like sight unseen. Like he bought it and he got it to us. And there all have been other people, like work print type collectors, that messaging us later that saying like, we hate you, we should have won that, that's our tape, you know, you don't deserve it, and we wanted it for our thing, and that we wanted to just buy it and not let anybody ever see it. So like, thank goodness, because like, that's who this thing could have gone to, and it would have collected dust
and then eventually
or traded it for something else.
Fascinated by this work print collectors community like threatening
they hold it so they can get other things. It's insane, but it's like its own so
it's Ryan like Parente. Best in Show. I just see all of those characters from Best in Show is like that, those work print collectors.
We need a deep dive into this world, into this community.
It would be fascinating. You'll get like witness protection people being like, you know, I'm sure it would be like interesting. But so like Ryan Parente from our community, who had been like doing like stuff for us for a while, just like he's big into like translating like Japanese articles and things like that for us. Like, he acquired the tape, you know, and he got it like an initial he did like an initial scan of it and all that to see like what it was and what is this thing, was very communicative with us of like, oh yeah, like, you know, I'm getting it to the people that need it, that so we can control the fate of whatever comes out of this. And we found out like, oh my God, it's not just cut footage. It is like it's what the state of the movie was in December of 1992. And of course it was legit. Like, it would be impossible to fake that kind of thing, but like the same seller had some trophies and placards and awards, like that were like Roland Joffe's awards or whatever, or this goes to Leitmotiv or whatever, Roland Joffe award. So it was like clearly from like some kind of Leitmotiv storage locker, that
a storage locker.
Yeah. Storage like locker at auction. An office. Yeah. Just sort of, yeah. And someone's gone and picked 10 videos off a shelf and gone, I'll plug it in and I'll just see what that is.
Oh my God. That is so wild.
Crazy.
It's like that same seller had stuff. So we were like, okay, so it must have been like something that Leitmotiv had, or something that, you know, one of the producers actually had. So that's the closest like confirmation to like, that's where the source is. But we got the VHS tape. It's roughly dated. So we know when it's from, and we just kind of went from there, like getting it scanned so we can watch it. And then it went through this giant, transformation of like trying to get good scans of it. Like, people from Ryan Parente's end did scans, and we sent it to other people we had worked with other content to get their own scans. Eventually it came to me in my possession, and I was able to get Skip Elmer of AV Geeks here in Raleigh, that worked with me on some screenings of the film already. And he had scanned some of my 35 millimeter trailers. Like, he has all the equipment to do it. He's great. He does like 16 millimeter scans and things. He's wonderful. And so, like, thank goodness, like I had him as a resource. I was able to get him to make the best quality scan possible from that tape out of all the ones that we had done. And then that made its way to being restored enough to be released as that Morton Jenkel cut on the Internet Archive. And that was kind of its own separate thing, released for one of the anniversaries, because by that point the file of the work print got embroiled in the work print collector community, and we had these weird threats of like, we're going to release it as is and blah 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 blah, and I have another one that's dated whatever. And so this Morton Jenkel cut was kind of preemptively released to kind of holding it hostage. It was like, we're going to release it like this, so like, you can't, like, because we don't care or whatever. So it was this weird thing, and that's kind of how and why it got released the way it was. We were trying to make it kind of like as a proof of concept so we could use it for a future Blu-ray release.
So was that always the end goal? Like, you were like, because you're doing all these scans and trying to find these, like, you were like, we need this Blu-ray release. That was always the goal. Yeah.
Yes. And so, like, for years, like, you know, the whole process, post-production process of Super Mario Brothers is pretty well documented, to where the Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jenkel, the directors, kind of were unceremoniously kicked off the set, like, 3/4 of the way through, and the rest of the cast and crew had to kind of band together and figure out how to finish the movie. And Rocky and Annabelle were allowed to come back into the editing room way later on in the process. But like, it's kind of a compromised vision in terms of like what they wanted to do. And so our, you know, dream goal, which still has not come to fruition, but a lot has, our dream goal was to like, let's restore this in a digestible way that's better than the work print, because we have the finished film now. Like, how do we make the best possible quality so we can work with the directors to do an actual director's cut?
Yeah.
And Rocky and Annabelle actually are great. Like, Annabelle loves this. Like, she knows this like by first name or whatever. Like, she's just wonderful every time we talk to her or Rocky or whatever. And so that was the goal. It's like, we're trying to hold it hostage. We want to keep it so we can make it into something that's like worthy of release. But it kind of got put out there early and kind of misnamed, and but it was like the best of a weird situation, you know, which kind of is within theme of this whole project and film, like, anyway, so it kind of like fits. So I think that I don't want to get my timeline too mixed up,
but well, kind of added
oh,
to the...
actually, no, the timeline oh. does. Oh, I got it.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
But the, so like right around the time that that version came out, Umbrella had approached us, and said like, oh, we're going to release it on Blu-ray, later this year.
Their first release, which was a couple years ago.
Umbrella's initial release, which itself was sourced and licensed from Second Sight. So Second Sight in the UK had done their own Region 2 release a few years before that. And we also worked with them on that release because they got our permission and wanted to work with us to be, we gave them as much carte blanche of things that they could pull from the website, or we gave them like better high resolution files of things. And we gave them that Roland Joffe interview we had. Right. And we were, me and Steven were like producers on the featurette that went on that disc. So we were really instrumental in getting all the special features on that Second Sight Blu-ray. And of course, at the time we thought like, well, this is as good as it's ever going to get. And it was the first time we had seen the film in high definition on Blu-ray, which is a huge step up from the DVD, which is just absolutely, it's a very poor DVD can be great, but that DVD is horrible quality. So the Second Sight one existed. Years later, Umbrella comes to us and say, hey, we licensed the stuff from there. Do you, we want to work with you. Like, do you have anything else you want to put on it? We're like, oh, we have this work print. and so we were able to put Skip's best quality at the time transfer on that disc, which was like the raw version of the Morton Jankel cut. So that's its own thing. And we were able to put as kind of like a, well, that's already out there. So we want to put the archival version, the raw VHS, on there because it was a fast deadline and there was not going to be enough time to like do actual new cut. So like, this is like a, hey, this is a huge selling point for you guys. And then, you know, we thought that would be that's as good as it's going to get.
As good as get,
And then clearly it sold very well for Umbrella to where when it was clear that there was going to be a 4K scan done, Umbrella was the first company to jump on it and say, okay, we want to be the first people to bring this to market. What do you do? Hey, SMB Archive, what can we do? And that weird, that just that couple years or whatever in between releases has been this big shift in physical media where these boutique labels are trying to like do more stuff to cater to the people that want to buy them versus, you know, there's a lot less studio films coming out on the format, which sucks, but helps people like us trying to do, you know, niche content. And so at that point we're like, okay, but it was still not under duress, but we had a timeline, we had a budget, but me and Steven were like, well, this probably really is as good as it's going to get. I'm sure it could come out again, but like, I don't think we're going to have, and
yeah,
like,
but with all this stuff, I mean, like, is Umbrella saying, give us your archive, we want to like make this tangible, like,
yeah, so like,
or were you selling them on it?
It was both. Yeah. Umbrella knew it would sell. They had already had the experience of adding all these other freebies and things with their other releases. So they kind of knew what they could do, and they presented us with, here's a bunch of stuff we could do. What do you want to do? And we kind of cherry picked, we can do X, Y, and Z, but not that. What do you guys think about, you know, all this other stuff? And basically we did almost everything we wanted to do, but a lot of the physical stuff came. Actually, it was a good collaboration between both of us, where they wanted to do scripts and we told them which scripts to get, and they wanted to do the book, and we were able to source all this extra stuff that's just not on the website or higher resolution than the website, and they were able to do things like pull interviews and republish things, which is really cool because it like takes the archive and makes it more of a real companion. And Ben Gurley, who's been, who is also Australian and has been helping us with stuff, like restore a lot of things. Like he, I think he donated one of his trailers to them so they could slice it up and put it into the film cells and all that stuff. So Umbrella was taking care of a lot of the physical production work, like, and it was wild. Like a lot of the art on there is actually sourced from like things that I own. Like I was taking photos and scans of apparel and things that I had like on a Friday, and then by Tuesday when the assist set got announced, like they had turned, their designers had turned my pictures and scans into like, this is what the box is going to look like. And I'm just like, wow, like it's crazy to like have that. Like I can't believe I'm the person doing that. And we got to present, and we were really instrumental in being like, okay, we want these we want to try to get these extra cuts, we want all these commentaries. And they're like, yeah, sure, if you can get David Snyder or Parker Bennett or, you know, all this Wilmington crew, whoever you can, whatever content you think you can get produced by X date, do it.
It'll be
yeah. The onus was on us to actually do it. And so it was an insane few months of us doing that. And we even like, we're like, hey, can we do our own commentary? And they were like, yeah. And they were like, shit, we have to do our own commentary. Because like, and it was, we had to, it was so hard to like stop what we were doing, you know, and yeah. All this crazy stuff happened in between. Like Steven had his first child was born. Like I worked at Volition and our whole studio got shut down in the middle of this thing. And we're still like trying to work on this project and get it done. And then of course the big icing on the cake of everything was getting this 5-layer lasagna cut done. And Steven was able to find and track down the bigger pictures, J.S. Wingfield, to kind of work on this thing. And so every single day for like a few months, he worked tirelessly on that work print to like squeeze every bit of
wow
data out of this thing. And we were trying to work towards getting more director's cut type things or alternate cuts. We wanted like a director's cut and an alternate cut on top of that, like our own personal, like this is another way to view the movie inspired by, because we were inspired by the I guess me, like the me even more, but like the Arrow Waterworld release where they've got like the TV cut and like the fan like Ulysses cut on there. So we were like, we wanted to do that, but just getting the clearances and approvals for it wouldn't match up with the timeline. But we were like, Rocky and Annabelle were like on board with it, and they were giving us like notes of like what they wanted to see in the movie, and oh, should we change the X, Y, or Z? Oh yeah, we won't like this and not that. And so we got as much director approval for things as we could to try to make as close to a director's cut as we could, but we couldn't cross the finish line with it. But even saying that, like the set comes out and it's got all this stuff, and it was incredible. Just like a marathon, and we didn't. I'm still comprehending like what was accomplished there, and all these reviews come out of like, this is like one of the, if we could give this higher than 5 stars, we would, or this is one of the best releases we've seen in like the past 5 years and stuff. And we're just like, we want to do more. Can we do more? You know?
Yeah.
And the sales have been so good. Like it sold out immediately. The Trust the Fungus edition was like, it's been selling on eBay for like $500, and then they weren't going to, yeah, like it was just because it was limited. It was limited edition.
Yeah.
And it sold so well.
Only 2,250 of the actual Trust Fungus cut.
Are you guys going to do another one?
It's
like another run.
The answer is yes. Yeah. Umbrella actually wasn't going to, but then like basically the fans had spoken. literally demanded it. So Umbrella is doing this amazing thing where they are making a one-up edition of this, where it's like a version two of the Trust the Fungus edition, where they've like, there's not a film cell, the hardcover books are now soft cover, but most all of the content is there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually alternate artwork now, so it's its own thing also. It's a unlimited pre-order, so they're not limiting it. And there is also a version that is just the bits, just the stuff without the movie. So if you did buy just the disc, you can you can buy the extras now, which is like such a great,
that's cool.
That's very
it's like
cool.
A cool fan forward thing to do where they're like, yeah, it's expensive and stuff, but they're not trying to like make people double dip.
Like, if you've already got the disc,
we didn't know how popular it was. Like, but here's just the stuff if you want the stuff, which for us is like Archivist is great because even if you've got another version of the movie or don't want to see or don't need the 4K or have the other thing, you could buy the stuff just for the book. And some people have said, I'm getting that just so I can have the physical, the scripts and the book and the, you know, all that stuff in it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an amazing just journey to listen to your story. And I have to like wonder your parents refusing to show you the movie when you were in second grade. And now this is sort of like your life's work. I mean, I relate to that too. What do they think of all this?
They're just like, wow. Like, I don't, you know, it's like they can't comprehend it a lot of times. It's like, oh, you're doing that, or oh, you're hosting a screening, or okay, well, okay, yeah, that's crazy. Or, you know, I mean, the weirdest things happen. We've done a lot of interviews with people, like, I guess it comes down to like the parent thing of like, it needs to, like, they know what the movie is and everything, but it's like, oh, we got interviewed by this newspaper, or a few years ago, like Playboy interviewed me and Steven. It's like, oh, I got to talk to this journalist from Playboy today. And they're like, what? Like, they just are like, that is like the gauge of like how big this thing is or whatever.
Right. Right. I love that though. I mean, I think we can all relate like to being a kid who's obsessed with movies or TV or video games or whatever it is. And my dad being like, you're watching too much TV. And I'm like, I'll show you.
I'll show you, Dad.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So good. And so it's just, I'm so happy to like hear your story because this has just been, I just love the, you know, the idea of like building something just to build it. And then taking that journey with the people that show up that say, hey, I love this thing too. And the positivity of it. I think Blake and I always talk about the like positive hot takes is like our mantra. And I think, you know, with One Heat Minute Productions and with the Super Mario Brothers archive, it's like, you guys are kind of leading the way on how to be a good fan in the world.
Yeah. You guys are doing like really inspirational stuff. I feel a great deal of kinship with just that, having a compulsion to do something for no other reason. So hearing your story is so awesome. And yeah, like, as you said, if you were ever measuring what the pièce de résistance is, it's like literally Super Mario Brothers, like 93 has the best physical media box set arguably that exists.
Yeah.
And it's because of everything that you guys did, which is so, so incredible.
And not only that, it's all these crazy dominoes actually falling the right way too.
Yes.
Because like this also doesn't happen if there's not this weird loophole of an Australian company being able to license it, because the United States distribution and ownership of it is actually through Disney, and it's a Nintendo owned property, and Nintendo is like one of the biggest entertainment brands in the world, and they're very very controlling over their properties and their IP. So the two most like IP like controlling companies you could possibly have, Disney and Nintendo, this shouldn't happen. So but it's a distribution thing that is only in North America.
Bless the gaps in international copyright law for us to be able to legally distribute it.
And Leitmotiv and Allied Filmmakers dissolving made the film rights go back to the French company Pathé, and then they can license it out wherever in the world, as long as it's their film and they just keep it to that movie. They can do whatever they want as long as it's in the correct territory. So Umbrella can take it, and people like us who actually give a shit and have the stuff can work with the company to make things. And that just would not happen if this was like a American produced Disney Nintendo thing. So it's like extremely grateful that we were able to like take that fandom and actually get it out there and make it a reality that way.
Yeah, and make it a tangible thing that you can hold and own and yeah. share in. And I just love that. And I also love thinking about like international licensing laws and how that affects the art yeah. that we have access to. And I mean, I think it's fascinating. I think the way industry and art overlap is fascinating. So mm-hmm. you're dead on. So that's super, super interesting. But this has been such an interesting, fun time talking to you and hearing all about it. And I'm very glad I fell through the portal of the SMB fandom yeah. because it's been a fascinating ride and everyone has been very, very nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's great to hear. And, you know, it's good to see fandoms behave that way and
exactly.
be able to kind of latch onto things like the other one that I think is one to keep your eye on that's gone through a slightly similar transformation to us is the, you're not ever going to guess what I'm going to say. It would be the Ernest fandom.
Oh, the Ernest Scared Stupid. And yes, Ernest yes, goes to camp.
Yes, yes. A few years ago, there was like one podcast and now there's like 10. There was like a character analysis podcast, a script analysis podcast. Well, the one of the people of the Ernest Brain Trust in the 90s has given all the dead scripts that were never produced to these people and they're making podcasts about each script. And there's like an Ernest Day, like in Tennessee where they filmed Ernest Goes to Camp and all the Ernest fans just like congeal there. So like, yes, it's its own crazy story. So
there will be a Ernest box set
somewhere.
Imminently.
Yeah. Imminently on Umbrella. And yeah. I tell you what, Ernest Scared Stupid. I really like that. It's a really cute kids horror movie. I'm a big fan. Ryan, thank you so much for your time. We won't keep you any longer. This has been an epic conversation. Your as Katie said, your life's work in a box on SMB Archive. It's been super, super great to talk to you. And just, yeah, thank you so much for your great work. And thanks for sharing your story because it was really, really awesome to get to know you a little bit better through your story. So, yeah, this has been a treat. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks.